Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. American women waited a long time to gain the right to vote. Left out of our country's founding documents, a women's suffrage movement began in the mid-1800s. Still, it took many more decades before the 19th Amendment to the Constitution added female voting rights, made official in August of 1920. It was a huge win for women, but not all of them. Women of color would have to wait even longer to have their voting rights guaranteed. Now, as this centennial of women's suffrage is celebrated, many historians say it's important to remember who was included in this victory and who was not. Exchange listeners, we welcome your questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Martha Jones, a Society of Black Alumni presidential professor and a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. Martha's forthcoming book is Vanguard: How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Also with us, Susan Ware, honorary women's suffrage centennial historian at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Susan is the author of Why They Marched: Untold Stories of the Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. A big welcome to both of you. And before we get into the history, I do want to start with the current day. As you know, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden named Kamala Harris for his vice presidential pick just yesterday. And Martha, to you first, how does that fit into this history that both you and Susan are telling?
Well, here we are 100 years after the 19th Amendment, and we have the first African-American woman to be nominated to a major party vice presidential slot. It tells us something about the extraordinary distance that all American women have traveled, but especially African-American women who in large numbers don't actually receive the vote until 1965 and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So I think we appreciate with Senator Harris's nomination the extraordinary grit, the extraordinary persistence, and the extraordinary commitment to American democracy that women like Kamala Harris have demonstrated over the last generations.
What went through your mind yesterday, just personally, Martha, someone who studied this for a long time, and you know, you were preparing to be on the show with me, and you were writing a piece for the Washington Post, and then this nomination, you know, comes down.
Well, everybody wants to say how historic it is.
We'll hear that a lot, won't we?
Yeah, we will. But historic in what sense is really what ran through my mind. You know, Kamala Harris is not the first African-American woman to run for vice president in the United States. That distinction goes to Charlotta Bass from California, who ran in 1952 as the VP candidate for the Progressive Party. So I think that for me, I was on the Twitter last night trying to situate Senator Harris firmly in a history. She doesn't drop out of nowhere. She doesn't emerge from the ether. She comes out of a political tradition and some very tough roads that African-American women navigate to get to this place. I think among the most remarkable things is that she was not alone in this pool. She was one of six African-American women, each of whom were very different, women in their own right, with their own distinct political careers and trajectories and agendas. And that, in a sense, is as historic as her nomination.
Susan, I'd love your thoughts here too. Go ahead.
Well, I found myself strangely excited yesterday when I heard the news, even though we all knew it was that Biden would announce a woman as vice president, there is still something that kind of makes you smile as a woman when you think, yes, this is what should be happening at this moment in our country. And then thinking about it in the context of 2020, but also the long history that led to this point where this selection could happen. But again, I was excited and delighted and just hope she doesn't get eaten alive on the campaign trail, because that tends to happen to women candidates. But I think also looping it back to our topic at hand about women's suffrage and voting, obviously you wouldn't have a woman candidate on a major party ticket if there weren't women voters. And I think one of the things we need to remind ourselves is that 100 years ago, most American women could not vote. And when I talk to people about the movement, they sort of look at me like, really? Because it's hard for them to imagine half the population arbitrarily being denied the right to vote. So I always say, all right, the vote was an important milestone. It's not the end of the story, but it is part of this larger story of women's increasing roles in politics and public life.
Well, to that point you just made, Susan, how much do you think most Americans know about this struggle? And Susan, why don't you go first?
Well, I'm always a little surprised at how little background people have about the women's suffrage movement. Now, this is from someone like myself who's been studying women's history now for close to 50 years, and I'm pretty deep into the weeds of it. But there really isn't much familiarity beyond a few names, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Having said that, once you start sharing the story of the struggle and how long it took and what women were willing to do to win the vote, people are all in. They haven't heard this story before. They're fascinated by it. They're energized by it, and they want to learn more. And I think we see both of those things at play as we're getting ready to celebrate the centennial of the 19th Amendment.
Martha, what do you think? How much does your average person know about this struggle? And as Susan has written, it really was a struggle. This wasn't just marching up and down the street waving signs. But go ahead, Martha.
Well, for example, you'll often hear people say women were given the vote or women were granted the vote in 1920. And that's a point at which historians like me and like Susan and others are, if you will, obligated to do some myth busting. and maybe the first myth to bust is the notion that women were given or granted the vote, as others have more eloquently than I have put it, right? Women take the vote, women fight for the vote, women win the vote. And that opens the door then to this story about the hard fought road to the 19th Amendment. And then for many American women, as you've suggested, beyond that to the Voting Rights Act. But we have to dispel this idea that somehow women were given the vote.
Yeah, I read that yesterday. A lot of historians said, don't say women were given the right to vote. It was a fight. It was a struggle. Susan, you've written about this. How much of a struggle was it?
Well, it was a struggle that spanned almost a century. At least three generations of activists were part of the movement. And it really, in the end, came down to one vote in Tennessee, which shows you how hard fought it was. It was never a done deal. And I think that in some ways, the challenge of telling the story of the history of women's suffrage is that it is so broad and it intersects with so many other movements that sometimes it's hard to be able to make it accessible to modern folks who want to learn more about it. And that is why I, because I'm a biographer, often find that by telling individual stories, using individual women to frame the story, what they did is a way of making it come alive for modern readers. And but I think, again, we just need to remember that this is a long struggle. It involves political mobilization. It involves taking the message to the streets. It involves going to jail. It involves putting women's lives on the line. This is not just a bunch of boring old women in hats and purses standing outside Congress and saying, we would like the vote. This is a hard-fought political and social movement that women were involved in for almost 100 years.
Well, Susan, you've written about what happened to some of these women when they were put in jail. And you're right, there's this image of women standing out in, you know, big old-fashioned hats and long white dresses and saying, please give us the vote. And that's the image that we all have. But we hear they were thrown in jail, and it got pretty ugly in there, Susan, right? I mean, I don't think I appreciated until I was preparing for the show today just what some of these women put up with. So give us a little more there, Susan.
I think one of the things that impresses me the most is the stands that women took in support of suffrage. And many of these women were middle-class women, predominantly white, who were not used to standing on street corners and making speeches or picketing the White House and getting arrested and thrown into jail. And once they were thrown into jail, they decided to go on hunger strikes to protest the conditions. And when you think about the individual courage and the collective courage of these women saying, we believe in this struggle, in women getting the vote so much that we are willing to take these stands that they probably never would have thought they could have done in advance. And yet they felt at the moment that they were necessary to move the cause forward. And this did involve physical danger, terrible conditions, being beaten in jail. Force feeding is like a forcible rape in terms of women's bodies and being violated. This is really terrible stuff. And yet they persisted, to use a phrase we all know. And they did it for other women, so other women could have the vote. And that is an important part of the story, as is the women who worked within the system, who were doing the lobbying, who were buttonholing the congressmen, who were lining up the state legislatures. It takes a lot to have a successful social movement. And I think one of the things that's appealing for historians and also for modern readers is just to see the breadth of activism that you see contained in the suffrage movement, especially in its last decade, when things really begin to pop.
Well, a bunch more questions for you, but I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions about this centennial of the 19th Amendment, where women won the right to vote. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we welcome your questions and comments on this topic. You can use Facebook. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. That number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Martha, you and Susan have both written about how, as wonderful as this centennial is, Black women's voting rights weren't guaranteed until many decades later. So can you just explain that to us? How did that happen?
By the time the 19th Amendment comes out of Congress and is being ratified by the individual states, there is no secret but that too many African American women, women of color in the South and the West, are, despite a federal amendment, not going to have access to the polls. Black women are going to face poll taxes. They're going to face literacy tests. understanding tests, grandfather clauses, along with intimidation and violence. And so they must, in an important sense, gear up for a new voting rights movement that begins with ratification of the 19th Amendment and will continue through the 45 years that it takes to finally win federal legislation, the Voting Rights Act, that gives teeth to these federal amendments, now imposes federal oversight on those states that violate the spirit of the 15th Amendment, which had prohibited the states from using race as a criteria for voting, and then the 19th Amendment, which prohibits the use of sex. So for African American women, there is work to do on the ground in the fall of 1920, as they run suffrage schools and citizenship schools to try and prepare one another to overcome the hurdles that Jim Crow laws in the states will impose on them. But it is also a moment for linking arms to an important degree with African-American men now through civil rights organizations, through African-American women's political organizations, to wage a new campaign for women's voting rights. And we recognize how that culminates in the modern civil rights era.
So just to be clear, for people who aren't as familiar with the history as you both are, Martha, so in 1920, you know, the 19th Amendment, again, women win the right to vote. If a Black woman was living in an area that did not have some of those, you know, Jim Crow type laws, poll taxes and grandfather clauses and so forth, if she was living in a state that did not have that, she did have the right to vote. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes. So even before 1920, African American women are voting importantly, along with white women, in states like California and then Illinois and New York. So African American women are, yes, at the polls. They are, to an important degree, being woven into the fabric of the Republican Party and exercising leadership there. So Americans know that if Black women have the opportunity to register and vote, they will register and vote. And 1920 is really shrouded in the fear, particularly of white Democrats, that Black women will, if you will, make good on that after 1920 across the country. And that is the struggle of the fall of 1920.
So, Martha, it's partly a story of geography. Like, it really matters in this instance.
It really matters, I'd say, just as it does today. Americans don't vote in the same ways or have the same access to the polls across the country. States still determine a great deal of what it means to exercise voting rights in the United States, even in 2020. This was true in 1920, when individual states had a tremendous latitude to, if you will, suppress votes by facially neutral means that had a disproportionate effect on African Americans.
Let's go to our listeners. And Andy is calling in from Alton. Welcome, Andy. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was curious about the groups of women who were against the suffrage movement at that time, and how those groups might have changed their views after the 19th Amendment was passed.
Very interesting. And Susan, I'll throw that to you. Groups of women who were opposed to women getting the right to vote. Seems funny today, but I think Andy's right, Susan, huh?
He's definitely right. And I think this is very hard for people today to understand how women could be opposed to having women vote. And yet there was a very strong organized movement, mainly led by women, that were saying women don't need or want the vote. And this was they were a very potent political force, because let's say they go in and lobby a politician and they say, well, we we don't need or want the vote. And then the next lobbying group comes in as a group of suffragists, and the politician can say, well, I just had a group of women here and they said they don't want the vote. But the question underlying this is, well, why would women say they didn't want it?
Right. And what was their argument?
Their argument really looked at trying to, not saying that women shouldn't be involved in politics. After all, they are running a political movement against it, so they're very political, but they're trying to keep women out or above party politics. And at this time, party politics was a totally male, rather disreputable place for a woman to be. Most of the voting took place in saloons. It involved copious amounts of alcohol and boisterous behavior. And a lot of women wanted nothing to do with politics if that was what if it was going to be. And there's also a sense that these women have that they will have more political influence if they do not declare a partisan allegiance, that by stepping back from partisan politics and just looking at the issues, they will have more influence. And that actually is very close to the stance that the League of Women Voters took when it was founded in 1920. I've never followed up entirely on what happens to the anti-suffragists after August of 1920, but my sense is that probably most of them would have ended up exercising the right to vote, and I suspect that many of them would have joined their local League of Women Voters.
That's interesting. So women at the time were seen as the moral compass of the country, Susan, and they shouldn't degrade that important position by getting involved, you know, down in the dirt.
Yeah, except the suffragists also took the high moral ground and said that was precisely a reason for them to be given the vote. So you've got all kinds of arguments on all sides. But I do think it is important for us to remember that there were women opposed to the vote, and to give the anti-suffrage movement credit. And I think it helps also to remind us in the years that have come since that there are divisions across the political spectrum, from liberal to conservative. There is no such thing as a women's bloc or women agreeing on issues. And we certainly see foreshadowing of that back in the suffrage movement.
All right. Well, coming up, we will talk more about the 19th Amendment, this centennial of women winning the right to vote, and also where New England comes into this history. You can give us a call like Andy did at 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions and comments about this. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. 100 years ago, American women won the right to vote with the 19th Amendment on August 18th, 1920. We are looking back at this enormous victory this hour in The Exchange, how it was achieved, who was left out. And listeners, we welcome your stories, your questions, your comments. Send them in by email. That's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with two history professors who studied and written extensively about this movement, Martha Jones at Johns Hopkins University and Susan Ware at the Radcliffe Institute for advanced study. By the way, Susan will be speaking about this at the Monadnock Summer Lyceum this Sunday as part of a virtual 3-day commemoration of the suffrage centennial. We've got more information about that on our website. Both of you, I want to ask about a moment in history around this issue that I had not realized until I started doing research for the show. And Martha, I'll turn to you first. So post-Civil War, newly freed Black men win the right to vote first. And there's this debate going on, who should get the right first, women or newly freed Black men? Which to our modern ears sounds amazing. You know, this group deserves voting rights more than that group. But what were some of the arguments around this decision at the time, Martha?
I think the first thing to say is that Black women, men don't win the right to vote in 1870. The Constitution is amended such that the states can no longer use race as a criteria when meeting out voting rights. But there emerged many other ways to keep African American men from the polls, like grandfather clauses and poll taxes. And so that too is part of the story. But immediately after the Civil War, there is a debate among an old community of pre-war radicals, anti-slavery activists, women's rights activists, about how to engage with a political process that is unfolding in Congress and that is indeed going to reset the terms of everything from citizenship to voting rights during the 1860s. This is a story that's often told as a dispute between Black men on the one hand and some white women on the other, each of whom as a faction sees their interests as supreme or most urgent in this moment. Elizabeth Cady Stanton is often associated with one end of that spectrum and Frederick Douglass on the other. What I'd like to just introduce is that there are also African-American women in these debates, and they are not inclined to adopt a political position that would split this coalition or split voting rights along lines of race or gender or race and gender. And you can imagine why, because African-American women live and join politics at the intersection of those two sort of markers of social difference. So Frances Ellen Watkins Harper is among the Black women who takes part in these meetings. And Watkins Harper, you know, takes the view that this coalition should rise above man-made differences, as she would put it, between like race, like gender, to look for the shared human interest, and humanity is her word, look for the shared human interests that will hold this coalition together and that will move it forward. Now, we know that she doesn't carry the day in the 1860s and that this coalition indeed will fracture across many kinds of lines, and that African-American women will, by and large, move beyond and work away from the suffrage associations that emerge. But Frances Ellen Watkins Harper sets a high bar for American politics, no racism, no sexism. And I think today we can hear how strongly her ideas of the 1860s really guide our political philosophy here in the 21st century.
So how does it all shake out, Martha? You mentioned the coalition and then this question. How does it all end up?
Well, I'm not sure it has ended up, but I think what you mean is that
there are two
distinct women's suffrage associations. And by the time we get to the 1890s, the National American Women's Suffrage Association will in a sense, reconcile those differences for white American women and begin the road to the 19th Amendment, as we often tell the story. African American women will organize separately in the National Association of Colored Women. And there they will, yes, take up women's suffrage, but they will also, for example, be deeply committed, as committed to enacting federal anti-lynching legislation in the same period. So we have the emergence, if you will, of at least two suffrage movements by the 1890s, one principally led and membered by white American women, and a second led by and joined by Black American women.
Wow. So looking at that again with modern eyes, because that's where we are, Martha, in a way, it seems too bad that they couldn't get it together, that their forces would be more powerful if they could join.
Well, I'm not somebody who trades in counterfactuals too much, but I think you're probably right. Of course, that part of what is going to trouble this political scene is that racism is very much the order of the day and organizes American politics. Women are not immune from that. And there are going to be some women within the suffrage movement who are going to be willing to be complicit with and trade in anti-Black racism in an attempt to create enough political support for women's suffrage that ultimately a federal amendment might be possible.
Susan, I'd love your thoughts on this too. Go ahead, please.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, what we need to remember is that the suffrage movement and suffrage history doesn't just happen in a silo, you know, all by itself. It's always interacting with the whatever else is going on in American society at the time. And I remember we're really talking about a time span from the 1830s, really now we've extended it up to the 1960s. So you always have these moments where questions about women's rights and women's voting are intersecting or interacting with broader questions that are being debated, sometimes quite strongly. I think there's also a way that sometimes we think, when movements split, that's a bad thing. They should have stayed together and tried to work together. And yet I think you can make a case for the suffrage movement and probably for other social movements too, that sometimes it's not such a bad thing if you end up having two parallel movements or three, if you have, let's say, two white women's organizations and then African-American women working in, not in concert, towards the same general goal, but each mobilizing their own coalitions and they're pursuing their own strategies. And you certainly see that in the last decade of the movement in the 1910s, when you have two rival organizations in the suffrage movement, the mainstream group and Alice Paul's upstart National Women's Party. And I think that having both those groups actually, instead of impeding the victory, helped it. So again, we need to look at these, at what's going on as part of this larger picture.
Wow. Well, our phone number for listeners to join us with their questions and comments about the centennial of women winning the right to vote is 1-800-892-6477. Send us your comments by email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or, again, give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And both of you, we've talked about race and the role that it plays in this women's suffrage movement. Susan, what about class?
Well, class is obviously very important. It's the class privilege of the white middle-class women who lead the movement is central to their perceptions. But I think we do the movement a disservice if we think of it only as being of and speaking to the concerns of upper-middle-class white women. And at various points in the movement, there are strong contributions from especially working class activists, women who have cut their teeth in the labor movement and who know how to organize and who know how to stand on street corners and address a crowd that may be hostile. And they also begin to realize that they, as working women, can't really address the terrible conditions under which they're laboring without having any political power. and you get back to this realization that without a vote, politicians, it's just too easy for them to say, no, I don't have to listen to you. So you see working class women coming to a position that includes both class and gender and arguing for the vote and really talking about it as a way of improving women's lives. And I think that the energy and the spunk and the tactics that many of these working class women brought to the movement really helped push it over the top in the final decade.
Let's take another call. And this is Shaylee from Dover. Hi, Shaylee, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying the program. And my question is, like many, I know bits and pieces about the struggle, but especially because voting rights are once again becoming a flashpoint, I was wondering if your guests had any particular books they would recommend on the history of the suffrage movement.
Oh, great to hear from you, Shaylee. And both of you actually have written books about this. You've got a forthcoming one, Martha. So go ahead.
Oh, thanks for that opening, Shaylee. I'm happy to just say a little bit about Vanguard, which is my new book looking at 200 years of African-American women's political activism with a special lens on the story of voting rights. I begin in the early 19th century with some very path-breaking and sort of philosophers, Black women who really produced the first critiques of racism and sexism in the United States as a whole. And I come all the way forward to somebody like Stacey Abrams, or we might say today Kamala Harris, but is to say, I've really written a book that tries to situate the Black women that we're seeing here in the 21st century with so much political power. How do we explain them historically? It's not quite enough to tell the story of Susan Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Carrie Chapman Catt or Alice Paul, African-American women come out of another political tradition that begins with slavery and enslaved women's anti-slavery activism, comes through the women's suffrage movement and modern civil rights and brings us all the way to our own moment. So thanks for letting me sort of sketch out the story of Vanguard, which I hope will help us think better and more insightfully about what's happening right here in the 21st century.
Well, and for listeners who can't jot something down, we are going to put the name of the book on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Martha's book is Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. And Susan's book is Why They Marched, Untold Stories of the Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. So both of these will be on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And since you mentioned Alice Paul, Rebecca from Manchester emailed to say, I was a women's studies major at UMass Amherst, and my favorite suffragette was Alice Paul. I recommend the HBO movie Iron-Jawed Angels about her fight. And Rebecca says, my favorite quote is, well-behaved women seldom make history. So that's an email from Rebecca. Let's take a call from David in Keene. And David, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My question is, so basically slaves got to vote before women did, I believe. I know that in the mid 19th century there was a Black congressman. So that I just find it interesting that you know the degradation of who gets more marginalized, and it seems like women did in this regard. And that's just my comment.
Well, David, it's a great question, and Martha, you addressed it before, but I'll throw it to you again. You know, who gets more marginalized than someone else?
Enslaved people in the United States do not vote and never vote. The debate over, if you will, who votes first, who votes next, happens after the Civil War, after slavery has been abolished, after African Americans are equal citizens to white Americans in the United States. So the debate over who votes is not one that elevates enslaved people over others. Enslaved people unfortunately do not have access to formal politics in the United States. It is only after slavery's abolition that these debates emerge. But there is, of course, a debate about the relative urgency, the relative necessity of voting rights for Black American men versus white American women versus African American women. And so, as I said earlier, African American really women really urge that radical thinkers at least not engage in that kind of deal making and that kind of divvying up of political rights along arbitrary lines. But it's also a mistake to think that African American men win the vote before American women, because they do not. That state laws and violence will very quickly defeat the 15th Amendment and leave African American men in the American South disenfranchised until 1965, almost 100 years later.
Thanks for the call, David. And we'll take more of your calls after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send your comments in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. 100 years ago, American women won the right to vote with the 19th Amendment. We're looking back at this victory, how it was achieved, who was left out. And listeners, it's been great to hear from you. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. We welcome your questions at exchange@nhpr.org, or use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are two history professors who've studied and written about the American suffrage movement. They are Martha Jones at Johns Hopkins University and Susan Ware at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Susan will be speaking at the Monadnock Lyceum on Sunday as part of a 3-day virtual commemoration of the suffrage centennial. And both of you, we've got an email from Jennifer in Swansea, who says, I'm a local history educator in the Monadnock region. I wonder if your speakers can talk about anti-immigration as a motivating factor in the suffrage movement. I see this happening in New Hampshire from the 1850s with anti-Irish and anti-French Canadian sentiment, i.e. anti-Catholic, Jennifer says, which led to New Hampshire's own poll tax and literacy tests. As a white American woman married to an immigrant, I'm especially moved by the fact that if I had been voting in 1920, I would not have been allowed to vote. There were thousands of women who lost their citizenship status because of their marriage and were prevented from voting in 1920. Wow, Jennifer, there's a lot in there. Thank you. And Susan, what are you pulling out from Jennifer's email about anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic sentiment and how that plays into this story?
I'm pulling out some strong parallels in the arguments that were made against African-American men voting and why white women should have priority. Many of the same things are said by suffrage leaders against immigrant voters. And it's an unfortunate example of nativism going alongside the racism of the movement. And I think it comes from a sense of entitlement on the part of many of these white women who really felt that they deserved the right to vote more so than other groups in the country, and they were not shy about deploying arguments using that that logic. It's very much there, and I think it's very important what you've identified is also looking at state restrictions. I mean, we think of the 19th Amendment is a federal amendment it's an amendment to the federal Constitution. But the real nitty-gritty of voting takes place in states. And so what you're going to find on the ground is lots of variations. And in the South, the priority is disfranchising African Americans. Immigrants aren't as much of a problem. In a place like New Hampshire or Massachusetts, it's going to be the immigrants. And there are ways in which the people in power who don't want certain people to vote then use state restrictions to keep them away from the polls. The other thing you mentioned is a fact of citizenship and marriage, where an American woman, if she marries a foreigner up until 1923 and the Cable Act, she loses her citizenship. And this is one of those laws that was just like a red flag to suffragists and in the period afterwards, where they said, this is wrong, we need to fix this. And they were able to do that. But again, it speaks to the a certain shakiness in women's legal status around issues of citizenship and marriage that is very much part of the story.
Wow. So that's really interesting. So when Jennifer says, as an American woman married to an immigrant, she's moved by the fact that if she had been voting in 1920, she would not have been allowed to do so because she was married to an immigrant. You lost your citizenship when you married an immigrant.
A foreign citizen, yes.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly. Wow, I did not know that. Jennifer, thank you so much for writing in. Let's go to Danielle in Hanover. Hi, Danielle, you're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi there. I cannot get over the sense of deep disappointment that we're even framing this conversation in this way. I think that as long as white women continue to call this a centennial and continue to celebrate that this is a victory, right? I mean, we're talking about no victory for Black women, and I just don't think there should be a celebration for some of us without an actual victory for all of us.
Well, Danielle, I don't know when you tapped into the conversation, but we did talk a lot about that. We've been weaving it all throughout our conversation. So maybe you missed that part.
The frame for this show and the conversation, and it's, you hear, unfortunately, this was deeply racist and deeply nativist, and unfortunately, we still continue to talk about it as though this is the centennial, and frankly, that's just not the case.
Okay. Danielle, I really appreciate you calling. And so, you know, Martha, what do you think? No cause for celebration, according to Danielle.
I really hear Danielle's point loud and clear. And I'll say I'm a historian. I'm not someone who organizes celebrations or commemorations at all. But I do think this anniversary is an opportunity, as Susan and I both, I think, are committed to bring good history to the conversation and to this moment. And that means not celebrating, but recognizing that the 19th Amendment is a landmark. I'll call it that. It is a landmark in the story, the long story of women's political power. And for some African-American women, it is a transformative moment. It does mean that they have access to the polls, to party politics. It is a base from which some African-American women work. But to your point, too many African-American women are going to be kept from the polls in this moment. And in this sense, for me, it's essential to couple any conversation about the 19th Amendment with the bigger story, which I think is a bigger story about voting rights in the United States that takes us through modern civil rights, that takes us to our very own moment where we continue to confront questions about access to the ballot in ways that disproportionately affect communities of color in the United States. So I can say I'm not someone here who's here much for celebration, but I do think for me it's been an important opportunity to revisit and to teach, if you will, some of the more difficult dimensions of the history of the 19th Amendment.
So Martha, to Danielle's point, would it be better, in your opinion, to say, not as this centennial is celebrated, but as this centennial is observed or reflected upon?
For me, that is more suitable language. But as I said, I'm a historian. I'm not somebody who organizes anniversaries or centennials. And so I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Well, Danielle, it's good to hear from you. What do you think, Susan?
I also try to avoid the word celebration because it has a kind of valedictory notion to it that women won, and that just is not true. And we know that that's not true. But I'm 100% with Martha about seeing this as a moment to be part of a national civic conversation about these questions of voting rights and citizenship and women's rights. And we're not celebrating the 19th Amendment. We are recognizing it as a marker or a milestone in a story that is so much larger than 1920 and the passage of a single amendment, and trying to see it as a story really without an ending. So you know, maybe once or twice I've slipped and used the word celebrate, but really what I think we're doing is marking and engaging this moment and trying to use it as a teaching moment to raise the kinds of issues that led both Martha and me to spend a lot of time writing books about the suffrage movement, trying to put the history, the broader history, in conversation with where we are today.
Paula on Facebook mentions, let's not forget, Paula says, the many Latina women without the right to vote, women who live their lives here yet are undocumented. Susan, have you written in your book other women of color, Native American women, Latina women, as Paula mentions, who were also involved in this struggle? I know you profile 19 sort of lesser known heroines of this movement.
In my book, my women are predominantly white and African American. And yet there is some very exciting new scholarship that is just coming out about the roles that Latina women played in especially in the American Southwest, and the roles of Native American women, who were yet another group that were not enfranchised by the 19th Amendment, because Native Americans were not considered citizens until 1924, so they couldn't vote anyway. I think what's going to be really interesting is just looking at the chronology. The suffrage movement, because it starts in the 1830s or even perhaps a little bit before, spans through 1920, then you need to cross-cut that with what the history of Mexican Americans in the Southwest and in California is like. My sense is that whenever we start digging, we do find women's activism in these communities. How much of it is going to be specifically around suffrage that early, I don't really know. So I am eagerly awaiting the publication of some of this new scholarship.
Martha, you're looking at that as well.
So I have in mind Kathleen Cahill's forthcoming book called Recasting the Ballot, where she takes care, importantly, to chronicle the ways in which Latinas, Asian women, Native American women are also very much a part of this story, having variously exercised political rights in their own communities and historically being disenfranchised in the U.S. political regime, mainstream political regime, and not unlike African American women, still facing a struggle after 1920 to win full voting rights. And so, yes, it's very important, I think, as your listener points out, that we use this year to broaden out the lens and to understand that much of this history's country is a history of voter suppression. It's not a term that would have been used at the early part of the 20th century, and yet we can recognize, looking back, the ways in which, as much as we focus on the dynamics of expanding the electorate and welcoming new voters into the body politic, there still was an important dimension of American democracy that remained committed to suppressing the votes of many other Americans.
Well, and as these recommendations for books to read and emerging scholarship come out, I want to let everybody know that we'll put them on our show post later today. So you can always check out our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Last question for both of you, and I'll have to make it quick. I apologize. Susan, to you first. What did you discover in your process of writing your book about this? Either like one person that you didn't know about before or one event that you hadn't encountered before?
Well, I think the thing that tickled me the most that I had no idea was that there was a connection between the women's suffrage movement and the sinking of the Titanic.
Oh, my
in
goodness.
1912. And it turned out that right after the Titanic went down, suffragists and anti-suffragists both started framing the story to their advantage. And the anti-suffragists said, this is exactly what we were talking about. Women and children first, the men will protect us. And then the suffragists said, we don't want anything to do with that. We should all be protected. I suppose it's an equal right to drown. But to me, that was just an indication of how central suffrage had become to popular discourse in 1912, that even something like the Titanic was being linked to a suffrage question.
Wow. Well, that's Susan Ware, honorary women's suffrage centennial historian at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. She's author of Why They Marched, Untold Stories of the Women Who Fought for the Right to Vote. She'll be at the Monadnock Lyceum this Sunday, virtually. For more information, go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. It was great to have you, Susan. And Martha, you too. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
That's Martha Jones, a Society of Black Alumni presidential professor and a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. Her forthcoming book is called Vanguard: How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. You've been listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.